5 4 0 5 4 0 6 1 6 1 0 9 0 1 4 0 9 0 1 4.
Saturday, the 31st of May 2014, the sharing economy explained in just 2 minutes. A Florida meth lab becomes a threat to dolphins.
I really don't know what's going on.
And the failure of hashtag diplomacy.
This hashtag is literally what the terrorists want.
Oh, what? Oh, dear God. Right, that's it. I'm going the full Godwin. This is the 9 p.m. Caltrain. Yeah, well, here we are then, on another journey, both physically and psychologically. That's the Caltrain you can hear in the background, the train that runs between San Jose and San Francisco in California. On this occasion, on a warm and sunny May afternoon. I'm not actually recording these words on the train, you must understand. I'm recording these words on a cold Saturday afternoon at Wentworth Falls in the Blue Mountains, because this podcast is a lie, as well as being cursed, as I explained last time. So I really hope you have listened last time so that you understand why this train or this podcast is cursed. Mostly the podcast. The train, I'm not so sure. Anyway, today I'm going to bring you some of my thoughts about the America, and especially the attitudes and worldviews I run into in Silicon Valley, because that's exactly where this train runs, stopping at Lawrence, Sunnyvale, Mountain View, Palo Alto, Menlo Park, and all the rest. This region is home to infotech companies like Yahoo and Juniper Networks and HP and Xerox and VMware and Palm. Remember Palm? And Symantec, Google, you'll have heard of Google. LinkedIn, I suspect you've heard of them as well. Lockheed Martin Space Systems, which is Space Systems rather than Infotech, but they have an enormous facility here. Northrop Grumman Marine Systems, and of course Stanford University, which for more than a century has dedicated itself to producing the technological brains that power this place. And my God, it looks a dump. Not Stanford. I haven't actually been to Stanford University. My understanding is that it's quite pretty, but Silicon Valley itself, it's mile after mile of anonymous office parks and light industrial facilities and the occasional big office campus or industrial swathe of machine shops. And it's all made more bleak by the fact that California is experiencing one of its worst droughts in decades. I've done this Caltrain trip before. I've been to Silicon Valley quite a few times, but it's never looked as dry as this. It was dusty, the sky was clear, and just all of the weeds on the edge of the railway track, which you'd expect to be green after spring rains, were not. They were dry and shriveled, and California is in for a long, hot summer, I think. There was even a crazy story in one of the papers, I'll link to it on the podcast website, which was suggesting that the aqueduct, the canal that normally brings water from northern and central parts of California down further south, well, that's actually not delivering enough water. In fact, there's not even enough water to run all of the lucrative crops in the Central Valley of California, things like pistachios and pomegranates and hipster fruit in general. So they're actually someone is actually talking about reversing the flow of the aqueduct, which is a neat trick. They actually want the water to run uphill. That's an engineering problem, but you know, hey, this is California, anything is possible. It's a real shame that Arnie Schwarzenegger still isn't governor of California, because I'd love to hear him pronounce reverse the aqueduct. That'd go down so well. Anyway, what's the same as my previous trips here are the people on the train. The vast majority are geeks and nerds of various ages and subspecies, mostly white, mostly male. And apart from a few neatly attired Asians, Chinese and Korean mostly, as far as I can tell, there were very few blacks and Hispanics on the train. And those that were older, and the way they were dressed says they were very much the service staff. In fact, when I was at the conference party for NetSuite's Suite World, now that's the reason I was in San Jose, the whole conference, not just the party, and NetSuite paid for my flights to the US, let's get that out of the way. But at the party, I noticed again the ethnic stratification. At all of these tech conferences in the US, the whites and the Asians are the ones chatting and drinking, and the Hispanics are the ones serving the food and drink. Blacks and Hispanics are the ones doing the cleaning, putting out the garbage, perhaps providing the security. That ethnic, that racial stratification is much more pronounced than in Australia, by and large. It really does stand out. Once you notice it, you see it everywhere. Now, we're right at the end of May, so I need to explain to you, the supporters of this podcast, how things will work in June, but I actually know you. I know how your minds work. You want to hear about the meth lab, right? I know you loved it when we brought you stories of meth labs before. You will remember the story of the world's most impatient meth cook from Oklahoma, the woman who actually wandered around Walmart to buy all of the things she needed to cook up meth and then started doing so on a shelf inside the Walmart. I still find it astounding that you can just go to Walmart and get everything you need to cook meth. But then, you know, you can buy ammunition at Walmart. You can buy bullets. Their house brand is American Eagle brand ammunition. And it's the ammunition I used last time I was in Las Vegas and at a shooting range there. It does the job. Perfectly cheap. I think it was $13 for a 60-round box of 9mm ammunition for my Browning pistol, and maybe only about $20 for a 60-round box of full NATO ammunition. Oh, hello, the station. They're about to close. There's meant to be announcements, too, about which station is next, but it was a kind of click noise, and then you couldn't actually hear what the conductor of the train was saying. But hey, what the hell, it's only Silicon Valley, and that's like analog technology is the train loudspeakers. So yeah, there you go. What was I talking about? Oh, meth stories. Yes, then there was the Australian guy who was doing meth and watching porn and masturbating as he might wish to do, but his girlfriend was complaining because her kids were kind of wandering about the house, but he wouldn't stop. So she stabbed him, as you do, and he fled from the house, as you do, and he went to his shed, but that didn't actually stop him from keeping on masturbating. No, it's like, hey, oh, I've been stabbed, whatever. God, this just feels good. So I know that you enjoyed those stories so much when we brought them to you on this podcast. So I know that you now want to hear this story from WFTV9 in Orlando, Florida.
A meth lab was discovered inside a hotel full of guests near International Drive. That lab was found early this morning at the Ramada Inn along Jamaican Court. It led to a partial evacuation. Channel 9's Sinead Broom has been at that scene since Eyewitness News Daybreak. And those evacuated guests, they have been allowed to return to their rooms.
It's a very different scene out here right now. No more law enforcement officers, no more hazmat crews out here. And yes, they have been able to go back into their rooms.
So what we're looking at here is basically a picture of a hotel. Gotta love television. Anyway, back to the story.
Now the only room we're told people can't get into is that one where they did find that meth lab. But at this point, the manager won't let us know which room that was. Gerald Williams came from Wales to spend more than a week in Orlando. This is what he saw outside of his Ramada Inn room this morning.
I really don't know what's going on, and nobody's saying anything.
The Orange County Sheriff's Office says people were cooking meth in one of the rooms right in the heart of the tourist district.
It could be catastrophic if there was an explosion. The exposures can be deadly. A woman called 911 early this morning to report a strong chemical odor coming from the room. The surrounding four rooms were evacuated while a hazmat crew tried to sort out what was inside.
The last thing that we want to be known for is something that's horrific that's happened here.
We saw investigators bring this woman out of the building in handcuffs and later saw her in a white jumpsuit. Investigators did that in case her clothing could expose them to dangerous chemicals. She, along with two other women, are in custody and could face charges for making meth. All three are from Orlando and Ocala and just recently checked into the room. The captain says they don't typically see this type of crime in this area, and it frustrates him people would try.
I would not want to be on vacation in a hotel with that type of activity around me. So absolutely, it's not fair to our guests. It's not fair to our business owners out here.
It's not fair. It's just not fair.
And we also have another crew talking right now to the manager about what they plan to do when it comes to trying to clean up the rooms and if they have any concerns about any of those surrounding rooms when it comes to any sort of chemical exposure. They'll have that for you coming up later today on Eyewitness News starting at 4 o'clock. Now reporting live in Orange County, Dinesh Broom, Channel 9 Eyewitness News.
Now what that TV report didn't mention, but the written report did, link on the website, is that the Meth Lab Hotel is just up the road from SeaWorld in Orlando, Florida. So you can start to see the real concern here now, can't you, people? Oh, yes, you can. Dolphins on meth. Just imagine that. How fucked would we be? Hello, I'm Still Gary, and welcome to The Edict. And through the magic of sound effects and a pocket-sized TARDIS, we're now in downtown San Jose. And they're the pedestrian crossing sounds. They're rather cute, aren't they? They're like birds, so I presume it's so that they're less intrusive. Look, before we go any further, some housekeeping from last week. I told a story that was from the mid-1980s, and I said, en passant, that John Howard was Prime Minister then. Well, bzzzt, no, he wasn't. I am an arsat. He was Leader of the Opposition then. John Howard wasn't Prime Minister until 1996, but hey, what's a decade here and there? You people are so fussy. I also got complaints for saying this. Back from hiatus, thanks to your support, this is the 9pm Shire. Let's hear it again. How did I say that word? Back from hiatus. What's the problem with this? That's perfectly good Latin. Let's check. What does the Macquarie Dictionary think? Let's look up the most thoroughly researched dictionary of Australian English there is, the Macquarie Dictionary. This is what Australians say.
Hiatus.
What?
Hiatus.
What?
Hiatus.
Oh, well, aren't I a stupid
cunt?
And I mentioned that Australia has an increasingly Tea Party-like government. I know what I should have said was an increasingly Tory government. I know it shows that I hadn't even listened to my own podcast, where we had Tea Party bits. Why are the birds getting louder? They have auto volume levels so they can be heard over the trucks. That's actually really very clever technology. Thank you, San Jose. It's enough housekeeping. If housekeeping is only about me being wrong, I don't see why we should have housekeeping at all. But before we leave the San Jose sound effects, I will say that apart from the glossy cleanliness of downtown San Jose, well, what counts for a downtown at 10 o'clock on a Friday morning, there was actually a bread line at the cathedral, a bread line. I never saw the queue with fewer than a dozen people in it, lining up each to get a single sandwich. You know, it wasn't even quite a soup kitchen. It was a literal bread line. For all of the supposed wealth of Silicon Valley, there is also poverty. No one saw it, though. They all just walked straight past. God bless America. TARDIS time again. Did you notice how we started off on the train from San Jose to San Francisco, and then we were back in San Jose earlier that same day? Yeah? Well, now we're jumping forward again, and I'm pretending to be in San Francisco, even though I'm not, on a Sunday evening, even though it's now Saturday, with the aid of ambient sound recorded on Market Street at the corner of 4th Street, I think, possibly 3rd Street, if I remember. 3rd or 4th Street, Market Street somewhere. Anyway, do try to keep up, will you? And I'm going to confuse the issue further, so hang on to your delicate bits here, boys and girls, by telling you about what I listened to on Friday night. So this is the sound of me on a Saturday night against sound effects on a Friday night. Me on a Saturday night against sound effects from a Sunday night telling you about what happened on a Friday night. Okay? To get into the spirit of things, it being a Friday, not a Saturday or a Sunday, I opened a couple of bottles of wine, turned on the television, and sat down to watch Fox News for the entire evening.
And welcome to this special edition of Hannity. And tonight, for the full hour, we're going to be joined by a distinguished studio audience, including women who have lived under Sharia law, to analyze the ignorance of the left when it comes to the rise of radical Islam.
The what? Sorry?
Analyze the ignorance of the left when it comes to the rise of radical Islam.
Okay, so that's apparently actually a thing. And the ignorance of the left is on display, says Mr. Hannity, in the hashtag Bring Back Our Girls.
Rather than calling for military action against the extremists, well, liberals have formulated a social media campaign to try and bring back the kidnapped schoolgirls. Now, it all started when the First Lady, Michelle Obama, posted this photo of her Twitter page using the hashtag Bring Back Our Girls. Now, the hashtag spread, and other Democrats, including Senator Mikulski, followed suit and posted similar pictures like the one you see right there. Now, I've repeatedly said this, and I'll say it again tonight. Terrorists, they likely don't read Twitter, and even if they did, it would have zero impact on them. It would probably only embolden them. And the only thing they'll react to probably is a bullet in their head.
So there's a lot of subtlety involved in this program, as you can hear. Hannity proved that the left was ignorant about the rise of radical Islam by showing us a montage of him repeatedly saying over the years that the left was ignorant of the rise of radical Islam. The rest of the show
seemed to consist
of angry people
shouting over each other.
And there was
a
lot of finger-pointing.
It was so excellent.
Hannity never allowed anyone to quite finish their sentence
before he came back with a question.
Which means there was never any time for people to pause,
think,
or breathe.
That's a fantastic technique, because the audience stops breathing,
and
too.
And they start to get more tense.
And we hear from different people.
Sean Hannity, for 4 years, Hillary Rodham Clinton, female Secretary of State, millions of miles, 200 countries, all over the world, she knew exactly about Sharia law. Hillary Rodham Clinton did nothing for 4 years to publicize and to hold the leaders accountable. She has some blood on her hands relative to her years as Secretary of State and her failure to put the cheese on the cracker when it came to Sharia law. Why didn't our female Secretary of State do something, one might ask, Rick Unger? Where was Hillary Rodham Clinton?
And we still can't breathe.
And the adrenaline surges.
And we lose the ability to think rationally.
So as an entertainment reporter, this is what I can say.
And all that's left is the rising anger.
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 This hashtag is literally what the terrorists want. Boko Haram has been trying to make a name for itself since 2008. In 2010, it thought it could make a name for itself by attacking the UN headquarters of Abuja. No one noticed. This hashtag, the First Lady, has suddenly given this Al-Qaeda affiliate exactly the global attention it wanted. She made the situation worse.
And then the advertising. There was plenty of advertising in between for things like real estate agents, lawn seeders, business hotels, telecommunications business bundles, retirement planning, cruise ship holidays, and toilet systems. Actually, one of the curious things about this was the big sales item was a toilet system that would flush without you having to touch it. That is, that you just wave your hand over the flush button detector thing and the toilet would actually flush itself, because you don't want to put your hand on the toilet. The toilet might be unsanitary, so you could flush it without touching it. What I couldn't work out is
how you would lift the seat.
And then it's back to Hannity.
And the fast-paced, angry argument.
And the inability to breathe.
And then the next show.
I forget what that was called.
But again, there was a lot of shouting.
Angry.
Finger-pointing.
Hello?
Then Bill O'Reilly came on. More finger-pointing. Tonight, a special report on how the left uses race and political correctness to attack those who don't agree with those leftist tenets.
Oh, okay.
The left attacks.
Attacks.
Using minorities as flashpoints.
And then more advertising. A lot of things are going on in my life, and the last thing I want to be thinking about is my dentures.
Fox News is fucking brilliant. Those programs are designed to ramp up the emotions, remove all rational thought, and build a visceral, tribal anger. By fucking brilliant, of course, hang on, we're still at the beach. We're meant to be back in San Francisco. There we go. By fucking brilliant, of course, I mean fucking evil. It's a cartoon cutout reality full of good and evil. Sharia law is bad because people get their hands chopped off, but yeah, forget that America still uses capital punishment. And O'Reilly goes on about the left always attacking anyone who doesn't agree with their tenets, yet at the same time, all he's doing is attacking the left. It's rampant hypocrisy, but wrapped up in such a way that people caught in this mirror world of bullshit don't actually see what's going on. I'm fascinated by it. It's like watching a car crash. And it's clear each time I go to the US and come back to Australia that our own government is trying to learn the same lessons. The question, though, for Australia is whether a random splatter gun like Mr. Rabbit can actually put the cheese on the cracker. Thanks to the tardification of this podcast, we have once more moved location and time. It's now Saturday after a couple, yes, I'm sure there are two Bloody Marys anyway at Vesuvio, and this is the sound of North Beach at the top end of San Francisco's Chinatown, and I think that's a suitable time and place to say thank you to the 54 supporters who've made this podcast possible. Thank you especially to the cheeky red supporters who've signed up to continue funding episodes each month. That's Paul McEwen, Benno Rice, Garth Kidd, Eric Rose, Chris Hill, Sil Mobile, who you remember from last time, Robin Parker, Dave Hall, Sean Richmond, Peter Lawler, and two who choose to remain anonymous. Thank you also to the Schooner supporters for continuing to throw money into the pot, and thanks to the Triple Shot, Quality Champagne, and Laying Down a Case supporters I listed last episode, and everyone else who's contributed in ways that didn't get your name listed. Here you know who you are. Thank you very much. Housekeeping, everyone who's owed a postcard, you should have received them by now. Maybe the ones from the US might take another day or two. And what happens in June? Well, we've got $300-odd in the continuing contribution pot. That's not quite enough to fund the $500 per ep that I'd originally set, but hey, close enough. So there will definitely be one episode in June. There will be more if you put in more. Watch the website for how to do that. There's already a one-off donation page at stilgerian.com/tip. So you can throw money in the pot for June straight away, and then listen to the music for a bit. Within the next 48 hours, I'll have membership pages up at the website too. But if you want this podcast to continue, you will need to throw money into the pot. Thank you. Back on the Caltrain for the final segment of this podcast, and this segment is triggered by an episode of the BBC World Service programme Global Business that I heard the other day about the sharing economy. Yeah, I nearly switched it off right there and then, but I then heard that the guest was going to be someone who was described as a guru of the sharing economy. Oh God, where's my gun? Rachel Boltzmann was her name. She's an Australian. And, of course, she's got a book. I mean, and she can't be a guru without a book, can you? It's from 2009, I think, and the title is What's Mine Is Yours. Now, one of my pet peeves is that the startup community has warped the meaning of sharing. And I don't mean just the whole, oh, let me share that with you, i.e. let me promote to you, let me boast to you. No, it's about this the sharing economy thing. Sharing, like, is a noble thing. As kids, we share our toys so others can play. As adults, we share a pint so we can enjoy each other's company. Sharing is about the free offering of what you have to others to create a sense of community. Sharing is not charging money for other people to use your stuff. That's called renting. It's a perfectly valid thing as well. It's just a different thing. So, as I say, I was worried when I heard sharing, guru, and book all in the one sentence. Nevertheless, I decided to listen to the whole thing, and it did raise some thoughts. I'll tell you those thoughts in a moment, but you do need to hear what Rachel Boltzmann had to say. And so that we can get that over and done with, I've condensed the entire thing down to just 2 minutes. It's a bit special.
I started to join different dots. Our digital behaviours around sharing behaviours transform money, transform technology, trust strangers, scale them, diversify them in ways that had never been possible before, empower people, become entrepreneurs in whole new ways. Value and value creation transformed through this shared economy. Shared sustainability component assets all around us unlock that wealth. People don't understand how these things are connected. Champion the movement. The space is very much under threat. Disruptive innovation. The concept of ownership is changing. Sharing. I never realized how much money I could make. Culture and brand. Magic and special. Change at scale can be better. Friction, peer-to-peer marketplaces, huge opportunity for change and disruption. There's a humanness, very special. Special trust. Trust is reputation. Reputation capital, empowering and exciting. Create value and have a new measure that gives you access to these marketplaces. It's growing incredibly quickly. The friction points, the collaborative economy, consumption of assets, disruption, consumption, peer-to-peer lending, the democratization of finance. We have to scale trust, peer trust, wealth creation, value destruction, create new forms of demand. You can scale up and you can scale down. There's a whole new model to value creation. It's on-demand needs fulfillment, new business models, new forms of value creation, new ways to interact with society, but we're actually seeing a new currency emerge. The currency of this new economy is trust. I think it's huge.
Now, I want to pick up a really important point that she made there.
The currency of this new economy is trust.
So what happens when you're a newcomer to this economy and the system knows nothing at all about you? How do you handle that?
So, for example, my husband is going to New York this week and he wanted to stay in Airbnb, but he has zero reputation, so no one would take him. So I logged on and the booking was accepted in an instant. So
not surprised, yes.
No. So he has no value in that system. He's like a guy, he has no credit history.
He hasn't used it.
Well, he's used it under my name. And I thought that was interesting that up to this point he saw no issue with that, but then he's starting to see that he has no reputational history.
And he's starting to see he needs it.
And what he actually said to me for the first time was, this is going to happen to me more and more in other marketplaces.
What I find interesting about that is that the guru of the sharing economy, a person who only moments beforehand had said that trust is at the core of this new economy, seems to have been quite happy to defraud the trust system by allowing her husband to pretend to be her, that is, to lie. And this is only a few years into this concept. Now, by coincidence, on WNYC's On the Media program recently, there was a story about the short-term hire car service Uber. Other people may know I'm a huge fan of them as well. Now, on Uber and other such services, passengers can rate the drivers, but drivers can also rate the passengers, which means that discrimination can happen. And in the United States, of course, that usually raises its ugly head as discrimination by race.
If a driver sees a request for a pickup come in from a passenger who has uploaded a photo, and the driver sees that the passenger is a racial minority, the fact that there's that electronic barrier again means that the driver doesn't have to look the passenger in the eye the same way that a cab driver would, however briefly, have to look a black person in the eye if they choose to drive past them without picking them up.
This is the same sort of bullshit, in a way, that happened earlier this month in New York, where some person wearing Google Glass went into a restaurant, was asked if they take off the Google Glass because other patrons didn't like it being there, and they stormed out in a half bleated online about discrimination, and then a whole bunch of their feral goldfish followers posted one-star reviews of that restaurant on some restaurant review site. They didn't actually go there. Most of them weren't even in New York. They just joined some random angry mob because somehow someone being asked to take off the television camera that's surveying people in a restaurant is being discriminated against. And that's, oh my God, you are being an oppressed minority. It's interesting that these glassholes go on about their rights, but they seem to be completely oblivious to the rights of anyone else to go peacefully about their fucking restaurant meal. Look, I've been unfair on Boltzmann. She does actually understand the concerns and at least some of the complexities of this idea of trust and reputation being wrapped into these invisible databases.
I don't like the idea of a number being the measure of your reputation, because you lose the context of the behavior and it becomes meaningless. I could be a really wonderful host and I could be a wonderful rabbit, but I could be an awful driver.
By rabbit, she means a person who does work via TaskRabbit.
I'm a huge advocate that we should own our reputation data. So it worries me that these companies essentially control your reputation and you have no say as to what is done with it.
And this is starting to get to the core of what irritates me. The sharing economy thing is just another example of wild-eyed enthusiasm for something that's cool because it happens to be on a smartphone. And yet, it has obvious huge gaps, gaps that are completely glossed over as, oh, just some little thing to fix up in the future. Look, having no say in what your rating is on Uber or even knowing why is so obviously a fundamental failure of due process. You know, let alone before we get on to talking about how you repair some sort of damage. It's so obvious that someone could, with malicious intent, really screw someone up. But the buzzword-addled wisdom of the clouds bullshit seems to be such strong Kool-Aid that all of the downsides are invisible. In fact, to pick on Boltzmann a bit more, okay, this is perhaps a bit unfair, but here's a snippet that sums up for me the core problem with the boosters of whatever flavour Kool-Aid we're talking about.
Whenever I sort of start to doubt whether this is a good thing, I always go and meet the entrepreneurs. I always go and meet the end users of these services, and you see the change that it has in their lives. You see how they're moving from just being consumers of society to really empowered citizens and collaborators and creators.
If you only look at the success stories, the successful entrepreneurs and the happy customers, and you only blog those happy stories and you only present those happy stories at conferences, then your worldview is bullshit. It's a hallucination and you are part of the problem. Yeah, I think that calls for an edict. This is edict number 25. If you fancy yourself as a disruptor, then you shall be required to look at the negative as well as the positive. You shall be required to talk to those who have lost money as the result of your glorious innovation, as well as those making it, those whose services have been degraded, as well as those who've seen them improve. You shall be required to consider every kind of participant in society, the very young and the very old, the sick as well as the healthy, those in rural areas as well as in the cities, those who speak English poorly or who are fearful or poorly educated or just plain poor, as well as the well-off, well-educated, confident, creative fucking entrepreneurs who infest our cities. And you shall be required to present their stories in fair proportion to the rest. Every time. And should you be found to have cherry-picked success stories to pad out your slide deck, or if you have been using Prezi at all, then you shall be locked in stocks in a public place for 7 days without food or water and pelted with rotten vegetables and the most acrid horse shit that the citizens can find. Because that would be just. That's all for the edict for now. Links to various of the things I mentioned are on the podcast webpage. You can also leave a comment there. Just type some words. Even better, leave an audio comment by Skyping to Stilgerian or by phoning Sydney +61 2 8011 3733. Record your thoughts. They'll go in the next episode. And even better than all of that, chuck in some support so that we can bring you further episodes. Because the next episode of the 9pm Edict will be sometime when you support it. I'm Stilgerian. See you then.
Seven, five, one, six, three. Seven, five, one, six, three. Five, two, eight, three, five. Five, two, eight. 3 5 2 7 4 6 3 2 7 4 6 3